Next, I had the pleasure of introducing Dr. Bob Nichols. I think he probably needs no introduction, and I'm going to be really tough to keep him on time.
He's good.
He's good? Okay.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As you'll see, there are a number of people on this paper, and really this is probably not an exclusive list. This list comprises the people who have directly contributed data or comments specifically to this paper, which I'm trying to advance. All right, I think it's very clear. Reniform nematode is considered to be the second most important nematode of the United States, but it's growing in importance. It's really been serious in the central part of the country for a very long time, and in fact, the southeast, it's becoming a problem. And we can discuss this. The nematologists, I'm sure, would be very interested, but you know, I want to convince you that this is really becoming very much of a problem in the whole eastern half of the U.S. Our objective here, and it is a very broad objective and an ambitious objective, really to take nematode control in the United States from a chemically based system to a biologically based system. And it sort of started out this way. In 2002, there was the kind of an uprising of cotton growers as expressed by the Cotton Incorporated Board, and that at that time, they were paying tech fees, which were kind of an innovation that they didn't particularly care for, and that we had an apparent yield plateau, which Bob Stepanovich and I have related to reniform nematode, in fact. And we were facing a real decrease, a slight but important decrease in quality. And that really caused a major change in Cotton Incorporated, which, among other things, caused Roy Cantrell to be hired as head of research, and Roy has cast a long shadow, and I think he's significantly improved our program, certainly an improvement in other areas as well, and has had an impact in this group, and I thank him for it. And at that time, you know, never to miss a challenge, I presented to him that Cotton Incorporated's program in nematology had become a circular meandering through two chemicals, and that in fact we should do this, host plant resistance. And he surprised me by saying that I should do this, whereas either Roy or Gay Givin would clearly have been better qualified. But it was a fantastic challenge, and I really thank him for it, because it's enabled me to do some of the most exciting science in my career. And at that time, one of the things I did was just survey. And did we have anything in hirsutum? And it was kind of questionable. Forrest had done this, but with single plants, and David Weaver and Kathy Lawrence, cooperators, actually surveyed and found that we had a true and normal distribution, but that even the best material had high reproduction. Barbadance is, in fact, interesting. Jim Starr and I and cooperators are working on a possible release now, which again has about maybe 60% suppression, unfortunately multigenic. We questioned it, but I think it should be documented. GB713 that you'll hear about actually looks very promising. Herbaceum is in, David Fong was working with this, and we hope that new position, that position is filled again. There's a possibility we can work in herbaceum. So there are all kinds of leads that we didn't have at that time. Amorianum, there's no report. Longicalyx is why we're here today. And what's going on with Longicalyx? Obviously, we've released the long-range lines, described the gene, and we have less progress than many of us would have wished. So what I'm going to do today is talk about 4 points. A brief history of the development, the subsequent observations that have actually delayed the registration. We're going to look specifically at the histology because it's important. There are at least two hypotheses of how this may work. And then where we are now and why we believe that the answer is in fact simple. That in fact it was as predicted, that we have a linkage drag problem, and why we intend to follow up on it, because we believe the material is valuable. So, Al Bell, sitting in the first row, developed the initial material, and I remember this is 2004 on a cold day at College Station in the greenhouse. There it is. And it was a fairly simple strategy. I think people have seen this before. We don't want to dwell on it. But the first idea that you would introduce the F genome by replacing some of the A through a basic crossing strategy. Everybody can read. I can read too. You can do it. F for D as well, and we generated two sorts of lines. It's like HLA and HHL, two acronyms that are based on the species names. So it's pretty clear. Then, in fact, in either case, we do get characters, and this is important. We actually have received characters from the bridging species. In the HHL lines, we can see petal spots, and in the HLA lines, we actually see characters for Amerianum as well, as having, you know, tracking specifically the longicalyx gene in this material. Okay. When we entered this project, this is 2005, Cotton Incorporated basically started a three-year project, put together a team to do this. And I think that was part of why we were able to pull it forward, and that we had Al's materials handling the breeding, Forrest Robinson did the nematode evaluation, Dave Stelly came on the program, is continuing the program for cytology, and Nilesh Dengue really was a very integrating effect here, put a lot of work in it. It was a dissertation project, and in fact is the primary author of the publication describing the genes. That's the background. Now, in fact, and we generated at the third, but really at the fifth, it was very secure, 26 bivalents, and moved forward. And in fact, the wonderful thing about it was that we were able to continuously screen and retain about 90% or better, maybe 95%, as says in the release, of the nematode resistance, okay? And this is actually from the paper, it's the Forrest paper, and it shows, you know, three extremely important points about this. First, that it's highly heritable, okay? Second, that in fact, there, when we work through successive back crosses with the phenotyping, that the nematode phenotyping is always a little bit imprecise. And in fact, the marker work really helped us accelerate this tremendously. So this project, among other things, illustrates the utility of marker-assisted breeding. All right, and obviously, Forrest, with cooperators, published. This is all available. The breeding scheme, how we got there. And then Nilesh and others published the genes that are linked with it, which is what we intended to do, because when we started this project, again, in 2005 at a meeting in Austin, we want to move this into the private sector and commercial breeding, and we were basically told that unless we provided adequate markers, it just wasn't going to happen. So we've actually provided a full package, all right? And people have seen these are published markers. And it's unfortunately, Al tells me the green fuzz is a very good indicator, and it's a published marker. But we have SSR markers inside the long arm of the chromosome. But this is interesting because this is chromosome 11. And we're looking at an insertion here in the same general area as we have the location of that root knot nematode gene on next to the CIROD 316. This is one of the reasons, Johnny, we went to the backs in this area, because we believe that region of the chromosome, the terminal region of the chromosome, may very well be a resistant gene-rich region. Because we also, from work from Phil Roberts, know that we have fusarium genes there. So I'm very interested in a fundamental way about resistance mechanisms, resistance genes, regulation of resistance genes. So that was all very good. And we basically decided to make a release. And I accept responsibility for this as much as anyone else. I urge the release. As people know, I tend to be optimistic and enthusiastic. And I felt that it made sense to get this material into breeders' hands. It may be, we may be criticized that we did not have sufficient evaluation at that time. I apologize that anybody thinks they've wasted their time. We, in good conscience, presented material that we thought had a very high level of resistance. And we do, as you'll see, have difficulties. All right. Mergai has very charitably characterized this. Some have less charitably characterized this. But what we see under heavy reniform nematode pressure is early season stunning. And this has been seen repeatedly and in different situations. Okay, this is an illustration of it. And it unfortunately continues. We do grow out of it, but it does produce an initial reaction. Okay? Clearly we grow out of it because the susceptible material here, and this is these are little pots, was unable to set a bowl, whereas the resistant material does mature and produce bowls, and it'll do so in the field as well. Okay. In 208, there was an attempt to make a concordance of these observations. And one of the things that shook out was that photosystem 2 herbicides seem to be associated with the stunting. And Al Bell made a growth chamber experiment and presented it the Beltwide, and we thought that we had a very good lead and this might be the answer. It was unfortunately not what we wanted, but of course Longicalyx is a wild plant. Cotton is only moderately resistant to the photosystem 2 herbicides anyway. And we thought this might be at least a big part of the answer. Subsequently, we discovered that it might not be the whole answer. The sensitivity is clearly there, but there may be more fundamental reasons behind it. Now, obviously, the infected stage of the reniform nematode is the female. Typically, this is not conspicuous in the field. This is a very heavy attack. But this is what they essentially do. Okay, the female comes in, and she goes through the endoplasm, comes into the pericycle, and actually is next to the root cortex, okay? And we actually have this. This is work by Paolo Guadella and published work in Journal of Nematology. Now, on the left side, do I have a pointer?
You can do it with the
mouse. I can do it with the mouse? Sorry?
Yeah. You can do it with the mouse here, too.
This mouse?
That mouse.
The real mouse. Okay. That is immediately above the head of the stylet. Okay? This, what is missing here, shows the inception of cell fusion. The interesting thing about it is the nuclei, about two cells away, are excited and actively, they're taking up more stains. They're metabolically active. Okay, that's the inception. That's the inception of a feeding site in susceptible material. Okay, this is what happens. Get over here. And look at this cellular damage. Now, Paul and I discussed this at some length. I am calling this, this is not what I'd call growth loss of cellular integrity, but it is cellular distortion at a fairly high level. See that? I mean, we're talking a radius of maybe 10 cells away where we're having collapsing and distortion. This area here, this staining in the center, is lignification. So this is a post-penetration mechanism. It may be metabolically costly, all right? And why did we get the same place again? Okay, and this shows the effect on the female. Okay, so the way we do this selection, we are selecting, okay, for reduction of reproduction, and it works! Okay, here we have a fat, happy female, and here we have a dead, desiccated female, right? All right, now, this is our hypothesis. The mechanism is not autocidal. I mean, we're not looking at a blowout of cells. We are looking at a mechanism that may have a metabolic cost. But our hypothesis is that the problem is not with the mechanism itself, although we are interested in the mechanism. The hypothesis is, in fact, classical linkage drag. Okay? So the strategy that we've taken is to continue crossing. Cotton Incorporated is coming back in this project. We want to try to find a robust recombinant, and that's our proposed solution. So, having done this, I have actually saved a minute. See how professional I am? And Jody Schieffer.
Thank you. We might not let you off the jet.